in 1200 BC. 1200 BC, you can imagine 1200 BC is a very ancient time from our point of view. It was in 1200 BC that in Phrygia, on the mountain called Ida, on the banks of a river called Xanthus, X-A-N-T-H-U-S, Xanthus, on the bank of the river called Xanthus, was this small town, or a big town, I might say. Considering the present day, it was a small town, but in those times it was a very big town called Ilion, or Troy, or Troves, or Troia. These are different names given to the same town. Sometimes we hear the word Troad, T-R-O-A-D, Troad, or Troia, T-R-O-Y-A, or Troy, or Ilion. You know the story written by Homer. Homer is a great poet who was at the time of this Trojan War, or the siege of Troy, or a little later, or much later, we do not know exactly, but Homer was one of the greatest poets of the human history. And he wrote about this siege of Troy, and that is called a very big book called Iliad, I-L-I-A-D, Iliad. It's a story of Ilion, therefore it's called Iliad. So it is this story, it's a story in which Apollo was ruling yet. But this rule of Apollo was already on the decline, even at that time, because even this great, great glory of Troy was toward the end. It was about to end. Apollo was already going to retire. He was told by the Supreme God, you had enough of your rule, now you have to retire. And Apollo was preparing to retire. So this whole story of siege of Troy is a beautiful story to be reread. You know, yesterday Dipti was asking me what is the significance of the bombardment of New York and Washington yesterday night. So immediately I remembered Sri Aurobindo's poem, Ilion. When something reaches a certain height, but not integral, then the savage forces destroy to remind them that your perfection is not perfection. You may feel proud that you are perfect, but you are not perfect. There is still something to be conquered. You are not conquered. Therefore the savage, the barbarian rises and destroys a civilization, or attempts to destroy a civilization, so that humanity may awake and may prepare for a greater development. So Troy had reached a very great glory, and then the Greeks, at that time Greeks were savages. Now we speak of Greeks as very civilized people, but at that time Greeks were savages. They were barbarians. And they invaded Troy, invaded Trojans. Trojans were civilized people. So Trojans were invaded by the barbarians, and ultimately Troy fell, was ruined, destroyed. And thereafter, Apollo retired, and then Athene began to rise, and then Greek civilization arose. That's why Sri Aurobindo says, siege of Troy led to the creation of Hellas. Hellas means Greece. So fall of Troy led to the development of Greece. That is the sequence of the development of history. So in that reign of Hellas, of Greece, after reaching the height in the time of Pericles, then came decline, and then came plateau. This is the second point which I wanted to emphasize. I have not spoken of all this last time. I am adding something more than what I had said last time about plateau. But this is the part of the understanding of plateau. And now, the third point which I had made about plateau was that he had declared the key to the permanence of civilization. He was very much concerned about the rise of civilization, decline of civilization, fall of civilization, destruction of civilization. And he was asking the question, why does this happen? And his answer was that philosophers are not kings. He said, if people become philosophers, and if they become kings, then there will be no decline, no fall, no destruction. There will be a continuous noon, continuous light of the day. He was very famous for his declaration that philosophers must be the kings, or kings must become the philosophers. Either of the two. Either philosophers should be the kings, or kings must become philosophers. This was his vision. A vision which is not easy to materialize. That is why I call it utopia. The word utopia is to be remembered. U-T-O-P-I-A. utopia. What is a utopia? A vision so great, not very easy to achieve, not easy to materialize, not easy to realize, then it is called utopia. A beautiful vision of the future in which everything is so beautiful and truthful and splendid. You make a beautiful picture. Many of you are artists, you should one day make a beautiful picture of a utopia where everything is bright and wonderful and beautiful. Imagine such an existence where everything is so smooth and harmonious, there is a rule of love and harmony. Everybody trusts everybody else. There is no jealousy, there is all cooperation, all brotherly, all existing together in a great harmony, you know, like a symphony. When you have a beautiful symphony, how beautiful, how it is wonderful, everything synchronizes. All melodies and harmonies come together. So like that, a beautiful symphony, and Plato spoke of that great harmony, great utopia. These are three things I spoke to you about last time when I had read about Plato. Now we shall read again what we had read already, and we shall go through it very rapidly. We shall read rather rapidly in the sense that if you do not raise any question at the end of every paragraph, I shall assume that you have understood and we shall go to the next paragraph without comment. If you have questions, then raise your hand and put a question, then I shall stop. Right? So let us read. The history of thought may, in a sense, be regarded as an account of the cyclical movement of the modes of knowledge, sensation, perception, reason, intuition, and still higher modes of cognition. At different periods, one or another of these predominates and asserts its own truth and standards of truth. Thus we have the age of intuition, such as that of the Veda and the Upanishad. The age of mixed intuition and reason, such as that of Darshanas in the East, and that of Socrates and Plato in the West. The age of pure reason, as that of Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz and Kant. And the age of the senses, as that of Locke and Hume in the present logical positivism. We shall stop for 2 minutes. If you have questions, put questions. Here I have given the entire history of thought of the whole world in one paragraph. In present, there was still a great period of intuition. So when we come to Pythagoras, this supremacy is lost, intuitive knowledge is lost. But still intuition predominates. In Socrates, we find the child of the mystics, capable of intuitive knowledge and contacting and following an inner voice. He called it the demon. But his methods of inquiry, have already become rational and dialectical. And in effect, he initiates the rational movement in Western philosophy. If you read Socrates, you find that he was guided by conscience, by intuition. We have read the trial of Socrates. You remember the trial of Socrates. We spent days and days in reading the defense of Socrates, the apology, in which he said, I have a demon within me. Whenever I am about to do something, if it is wrong, it comes forward and tells me, don't do it, it is wrong. Not reason, it is intuition, directly, intuitive knowledge. That was the power of Socrates. So he was a mystic. Mystic is the one who is ruled by intuition. A philosopher is one who is ruled by reason. That's the difference between mystic and a philosopher. So Socrates was still a kind of a mystic. But he was already becoming a rational philosopher. His method was already dialectical. A dialectical argument is one in which one set of facts is set against another set of facts and they are compared. The implications of one set are compared with the implications of another set. And out of the comparison, a new set of implications arises. A new set of perceptions, a new set of facts emerges. Now this can go on and on and on. This is called dialectical movement. Implications of one set compared with implications of another set, and then the two are brought together and a third set emerges. There is first a thesis, then there is antithesis, and then there is synthesis. This movement of moving from thesis to antithesis and antithesis to synthesis, and again this synthesis becomes a thesis, and out of that arises another antithesis, and then comes another synthesis, and on and on and on. This kind of movement is called dialectical movement, dialectical argument. Just open the second paragraph of the Life Divine and you will find this dialectical argument, in which you will find one set of facts set against second set of facts, and out of which, as synthesis, a third set of facts is taken out. Now this kind of movement is especially the movement of reason, not of intuition. When reason begins to operate, you will find dialectical movement. Wherever there is dialectical, there is reason. Where there is reason, there will be always a dialectical movement of thought. So this movement started with Socrates in the history of thought. So, yet in his most important doctrines, such as that of virtue is knowledge, he identifies knowledge with the knowledge belonging to the spiritual consciousness. And in his life, you find him being moved and motivated by the high ethical and spiritual sense. But when we come to Plato, we find that the mystic tendency is on the wane. You have seen the moon. Moon waxes and wanes. In the first half of the bright part of the month, the moon waxes, becomes bigger and bigger, until it reaches its climax, full moon. Then comes the second fortnight, in which the moon light begins to wane. The moon becomes smaller and smaller, and then the last day there is no moon at all. Now similarly, mysticism began to wane. It was like the second part of the month for the moon of spiritual light. It began to wane. We find the mystic tendency is on the wane, although the setting sun of mysticism casts his gold on the horizon. And you find in Plato a most captivating combination of mysticism and reason. I think I could have continued longer, but since I need rest, if you allow me, I shall stop here today, and we shall meet again tomorrow. All right?